This is the Crime Story Podcast with Carrie Ann Tholis, where stories of crime and justice are told. On today's podcast, we offer a special reprise presentation of the interview that Molly Miller and I conducted with Los Angeles District Attorney candidate George Gascon back in February of this year during the primary campaign. In March, Mr. Gascon and incumbent Los Angeles District Attorney Jackie Lacey received enough votes to move on to the general election runoff, which culminates on Election Day, 1 week from today, Tuesday, November 4th. You can find the two-part interview that I just conducted with Ms. Lacey at crimestory.com, and you can find a full transcript of this interview at crimestory.com as well. Welcome to our weekly podcast conversations. I'm joined by Molly Miller.
Hello.
Today we have a special guest, George Gascon, a candidate for LA District Attorney and former District Attorney of San Francisco, as well as several other jobs which we'll get into in the course of the conversation. Right. First of all, thank you for being here.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
What I'd like to do today is offer you an opportunity to tell us your narrative, your story.
Sure.
And what drove you to get into law enforcement initially, and then what shaped your path to becoming District Attorney of San Francisco and then resigning that position and running for District Attorney down here? First of all, tell us about your upbringing,
tell us
about your immigration to the United States, and some of the formative people, experiences, and influences on your early life.
Totally. So my family immigrated to the LA area in the late 1960s. And blue-collar family, factory workers. We moved into an area called Cudahy in southeast part of the county that recently got the notoriety for having Delta Airlines dump a bunch of jet fuel on about 20 school kids at about 2,700 feet. Kind of unthinkable that that would occur. You know, I grew up in a neighborhood that there was a lot of poverty. There were a lot of challenges. And, you know, English was a second language for me. Back in those days, that was in an incorporated area of the county. It was not a city then. And we were policed by the sheriff department. And, you know, some of the early experiences with American policing were not necessarily pleasant. I think that, you know, being in a poor area, in those days, actually still fairly racially mixed. There were a lot of Latinos coming in, but there were actually a lot of poor whites. Needless to say, the police wasn't necessarily welcome. I went to middle school in the area, went to Huntington Park, actually, at Nimitz, and then went to Bell High School, and I dropped out of school. And you know, early on, I was failing every class, and mostly driven by my inability to speak or read English. And, you know, at one point I met with a counselor in high school that, you know, he basically called me stupid and, you know, thought I was not college material. And that really encouraged my path to continue to be less and less engaged in school. Took on surfing. That was fun. It's a lot more fun than going to school, certainly at the time. And, you know, eventually I completely became disconnected with school. And then, you know, some of the kids that I was hanging around with, themselves, they're having a lot of problems. And I think, you know, for me, this led when I just turned 18, I really felt that the path that I was going was not necessarily the path that I wanted to take. And I wound up joining the Army. And the Army for me was actually the early savior, if you will. The people that I met, you know, the supervisor, which, you know, most non-commissioned officers and some of the officers, I was a hard worker. I was physically fit, and I think, you know, in that environment, that worked well for me. And those really were my early mentors. I didn't really have a bunch of mentors other than my parents and maybe, you know, people that I worked for. I was also working at a supermarket. But certainly they were not in school for me. So the Army really became the school for me. And that's where I actually completed my high school. I started going to college while I was in the Army. Promoted really early, actually became the youngest sergeant in my brigade. And I was, you know, I was very proud of that, especially because it was, by this time we were in the peacetime Army. You know, we had won from Vietnam, so promoting that early was not necessarily common. But then when it came time to leave, I also decided that, you know, I did not want to make the military my life. It was good for me for the time that I was there, but I wanted to come back out to civilian life, and did, and then went to Cal State Long Beach, and that's where I got my bachelor's degree. Initially, my goal was to become a history teacher. Really, I'm fascinated by history.
What parts of history?
This was really somewhat arbitrary because you had to concentrate in three areas in order to get your degree. And I concentrated in Greek and Roman classical history. I was fascinated by the sort of the early stages of democracy and, you know, with the Greek and then the transition into the Roman Republic. And then the other part was, you know, I really enjoyed the European transition from World War I into World War II and, you know, the early stages of Nazism. And actually, my area of concentration wasn't necessarily during World War II, but as a period before, and, you know, the failures of the Treaty of Versailles and, you know, all the things that came from poor policies, I guess, you know, after World War I that created an opportunity for a monster to later, you know, become the dominant figure in German politics. And I thought that was fascinating for me because it gave me a better understanding of the fragility of democracies and, you know, how quickly they can turn around. And my goodness, here we are today with somebody that, interestingly enough, talks about making America great again. And most people don't realize that actually that was a theme in Germany, was make Germany great again. And then the other area, because we had to just basically touch three bases, also the requirements. So I really got into the New Deal and the transition, you know, during the Roosevelt administration and, you know, the Depression and how the U.S. actually avoided a revolution, which is often not talked about. I think it's really interesting. Again, you know, looking at history and going back and forth, you know, people here today, you know, talk about, you know, some socialist ideas that are floating from some of the candidates like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and others is somehow this is a horrendous idea. But we forget actually that Franklin Roosevelt was pretty socialist, right? And that things like Social Security and Medicare, those are really socialist concepts. And I don't think anybody would go back and say we want to get rid of Social Security. Well, I shouldn't say that. Most people would not want to get rid of Social Security. And I think that most people will recognize that Medicare has actually been good to ensure that our senior population has medical care, which we hope that everyone should have. You should not have to wait until you're 65 to have medical care. And so I find it just so fascinating when people, you know, look at these things in such a narrow view. And we forget actually that, you know, most of the dams that we have today, the most of the, you know, big projects in this country were very socialist type projects. And it was a Democrat, a visionary, I think, that actually, you know, was help turn our nation around at a time where, you know, some people argue that, frankly, the U.S. could have been a place that it was ripe for a communist revolution at the time, right? Because, you know, poverty, homelessness, all those things were just so rampant, and there was so much anger going on. But anyway, that was the other area that I looked at. And then really, as I was getting ready to get out of college, a good friend of mine had become a police officer in LAPD, and, you know, they were really encouraging people with military background to come in the police department. That was a premium back then. Not sure that's a good thing, but it was certainly. And you know, police officers were making more money than teachers. They still do, which I think is we're upside down. Not that police officers should not get paid well, but it just shows how disconnected we are with the value of an education, and especially K-12 education. And, you know, we should. You know, there are nations like Scandinavia that, you know, in order to be a teacher, you have to really be in the top 10% of your class, and they get paid very well. And that pays off in the development of a society. And here we're the other way around. You know, we cut every corner not to pay our teachers well. We keep taking money away from public education. which we pay the price then dearly later on in criminal justice, right? We give up a dollar in education and we spend $10 in criminal justice later on. This is the world upside down. But anyway, one thing led to the other. I became a police officer and grew up in the LAPD through the ranks, all the way to being number two, running operations, which is the largest job at the time as an assistant chief.
How long were you... Can you break your path down through the police department a little bit more, like your climb to that position?
Yeah, so I started in Hollywood Division as a patrol officer. And then when I was going through college, I was in the GI Bill. I was working part-time as a shoe salesperson. And I got to meet a gentleman that was a general manager at an automobile dealership. And, you know, jokingly, after he came to buy one pair of shoes and wound up buying two, he asked how much money I made, which was, I forgot what it was. It was really, you know, very little back then and much less today if you were to do the equation. But he offers, says, you know, I'm sure that, you know, your skill set, we could probably get you to make a lot more than that. And I jokingly, you know, this is a very large Irish gentleman. So he did not look like a dope, like a drug dealer. But I said, well, so long as it's not selling drugs. And he joked, and said, ho, 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 of course not. It's, you know, he gave me his business card. And I wound up going and talking to him and wound up working part-time, you know, in the car dealership as I was just getting out of college. And then when I became a police officer, he kept saying, you'll come back. And I, you know, after about 3 years in the police department, I did go back because they made me some offers that monetarily were hard to refuse at the time, especially my former wife and I were thinking about having kids. And, you know, and so what I did is I went to the car dealership as a, basically on a track to, you know, I was made a manager, and they really spent a lot of money training me, you know, to learn the entire operation, and did very successfully there. But because I still really enjoyed the police work, what I did is I became a volunteer reservist, doing basically the same thing I did before, but not being paid, and, you know, working quite a bit of hours actually as a volunteer. So I never left the police department completely. And even though financially it was very successful in the automobile industry, 6 years later, well, prior to the 6 years later, but I decided I wanted to come back to the police department. The benefit, quite frankly, in that interim time was that as a 24-year-old, I was given the opportunity to manage a fairly large operation and really got a lot of training. They spent a lot of money on me. And, you know, more than simply in the car business, really understanding, you know, getting to understand how to run an organization, how to run budgets, how to deal with personnel issues. So by the time 6 years later I came back in the police department full-time again, I had this incredible experience that I would never have had in the police department, not at that early age. And that really propelled my career. And, you know, although I kept pushing, you know, I spent a lot of time in East LA, down in South LA, but I kept promoting in the process.
So I'm interested, you said growing up you had some negative interactions with police, or in your neighborhood there were some negative interactions. I'm wondering what your perspective was on police when you were a kid and how that changed then when you became a police officer yourself.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, first of all, I mean, even I'll take it one step back, you know, coming from communist Cuba, you know, our experience, especially because my family were dissidents, and they were not necessarily, they did not come from the wealthy. I mean, my father actually was a supporter of the revolution and risked his life, you know, during that process. But yet, when communism took over, he was a Democrat, and I don't mean that in a party sense. I mean, he wanted a democracy for Cuba, and obviously that did not occur. You know, then Fidel Castro, about a year into this thing, basically said democracy was really a tool for capitalists to exploit the poor, and we did not need the democracy. The way the people voted was they created the revolution, and that was a disappointment for my dad, and my dad became a dissident, and so we went through some really hard times there. And, you know, the police in those days in Cuba, again, was used as an arm of repression. So I grew up, I was very young, but it was like, you know, you saw a police car, you walked the other way, right? And you really avoided contact because it generally did not lead to a good thing if you were a political dissident. Then we get to LA, we get to Cudahy, and next thing I know is
what year was that?
Yeah, so we got to LA in 1967. Yeah,
and you came directly here from
straight here. Yeah, we came through the Freedom flight, so we landed in Florida, in Miami, but we were there really overnight. You know, my dad had now seen his mom, my grandmother, for that time, roughly a decade. She had left around 58, 57. We have family actually had been in the U.S. since the mid-50s. They initially lived in Providence, and they came to the L.A. area in the early 60s, running away from the cold. And, you know, my mother had heavy arthritis problems, and the doctor said, you need a drier climate. And they recommended out of the Phoenix or L.A. The whole family packed their bags, and everybody came. And Phoenix was a really small town back then, and then they didn't like it, so they came to L.A., and the rest is history. So by the time we came, we were in L.A. So, you know, then get into Cudahy, and, you know, the kids that I grew up with, they feared the police, and, you know, the police wasn't necessarily kind to us. And then as soon as I was old enough to have a card, we were getting stopped all the time, and the car would always get searched, and you got sat on the sidewalk, the typical police tactics, unfortunately, have been going on for decades when you deal in poor neighborhoods. I was fortunate enough that, you know, drugs really were not part of my growing up personally, although they were all around me, because, you know, I think I had more fear of my dad than I had a fear of the police. But nevertheless, you know, just because you were a kid in the neighborhood riding in a lowrider car and all that stuff, you got stopped. And there was never an apology after they searched the car, after they threw things on the sidewalk. It was, you left there, and life goes on. So that was sort of my world. You know, I mean, really, if you saw black and white, if you could walk the other way, I mean, we would run sometimes, which was the stupidest thing, because then the cops wanted to run after you, even though we haven't done anything wrong, just because you just didn't want to make any contact.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about your going back to the police force after your six-year stint at the car dealership.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so I never left, right, in the sense that I was a volunteer, so I kept, and that probably was the biggest reason why I came back. I think had I left completely, I probably would never have come back, right? I would have just sort of disengaged and gone into a different direction. And frankly, monetarily was a big hit for me to come back. I mean, the pay cut was brutal, to the point that actually for a while we had to move my parents. And, you know, by this time I had two little ones. So that was a really rough, not that my parents were not welcoming, but, you know, it's like, really, you know, coming back at 30 years old with a wife and two kids. But we could not even afford to live in the house that we lived before because, you know, we established a standard of living that was based on the income that I had, and all of a sudden that income got. But I you know, I just came to the decision that what I really wanted to do was back in policing, and I wanted to use the skill sets that I did in this area. I have a passion for, you know, public safety and community safety, and I came back.
What year was that?
Yeah, it was 1987 when I came back, yeah. And then, you know, like I said, I think I brought a new set of skills. I mean, I had a little bit from the military, but I think they really got a lot more, you know, in private industry. And you know, you come, generally private industry, you also develop a different way of looking at money, right? I mean, if you don't make money, you go out of business, right? In government, you have a tendency just to go through it, and you figure that it's a bottomless pit, which unfortunately the criminal justice system becomes a bottomless pit. You know, we just keep asking the taxpayers for more, and whether it works or not. You know, I jokingly say that if you looked at the return on investment for criminal justice, the whole system will collapse, right? So I came in really with a more fine-tuned attitude towards budgets and management and leadership.
And that, if I'm remembering correctly, that's the era of crack cocaine, of Crips and Bloods,
yeah,
and the emergence of the war on drugs crackdown. How did that factor into your reentry into full-time policing?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that was exactly it. This was really, we were at the pinnacle of the war on drugs, right? The war on drugs started a little early in the early 80s, but by the late 80s, 1990s, we were roaring. And, you know, and I became a drug warrior, right? I probably made as many arrests as the next. LAPD, God knows it. arresting people was not our problem, right? We did it en masse. And then it took me a while. I mean, really, you know, I grew up in that culture, and, you know, we would arrest people for, you know, very small possession of drugs for personal use, or they may be under the influence of drugs. And obviously, there were always poor people of color, right? We never got to arrest the drug users in West LA. That was it, unless it was a brown or the black kid that came into the West Side, right? So, and then as I kept growing through the system, I started to question what we were doing. And, you know, I've been one of those individuals that I'm always looking for answers. You know, I just don't relax, you know. I think, you know, they would probably call me attention deficit disorder today, but back when I grew up, that didn't exist. So luckily, so I did not get a bunch of drugs to deal with that. You know, I just kind of was allowed to be that way, right? And the more curious and the more uncomfortable I was getting, and the more that I would read, and then I started becoming involved in other organizations and educating myself. And of course, I had, in the interim, I had gone to law school, so then your world opens up also in other ways. And I just sort of, it was an evolution for me, right? And
who were some of the thinkers, the writers, the legal scholars particularly, that influenced the evolution in your thought about these things?
Yeah, you know, and going through law school, obviously, you know, you're force-fed a lot of stuff. And, you know, obviously, you know, one of the components is, you know, the evolution of constitutional law. And you know, I had some, you know, some instructors that were, you know, more left-leaning. So being exposed to a different way of thinking about the criminal justice system, questioning what police did, being very critical of police, and frankly, they knowing that I was a police officer, and so that certainly it was some of the faculty in during my legal education, you know, quite frankly, also, you know, drawing back from my own undergraduate experience, and then, you know, just I started working with other organizations. So I, you know, at one point, and then, you know, I'm really not moving fast forward, but, you know, I started working in justice reinvestment by the time we're in the mid-2000 series, and I became a board member of the Council of State Governments Justice Center. I started getting exposed to a lot of work through the VIRA Institute on criminal justice reform. Eventually got into the Kennedy School of Public Policy executive sessions on criminal justice, and I met people like Chris Stone, who used to run that organization, and many others. And then, so, you know, that path was a process of working with other organizations, you know, getting more engaged in criminal justice reform. People often say, well, what was the aha moment? There really wasn't one aha moment. It was just an evolution. One of the big moments for me, but in combination of many other things, was, you know, one of my daughters, who is an attorney now, incredibly bright woman, and she was a runner, and I was a runner. I mean, my other daughter, on the other hand, was not a runner, but, you know, also incredibly bright. They both are. But, you know, the runner daughter and I would sometimes spend time running and talking, and I remember, you know, I've never had like this horrible aversion to marijuana, but I did believe that marijuana was a sort of a gateway drug, you know, a very antiquated view of the drug, I guess, or the substance. I remember we're having one day a conversation about legalization of marijuana way before it was popular, right? And, you know, I was explaining my thought process around how this is sort of a gateway to other problems, which is very prevalent still in law enforcement circles today. Very wrongheaded, but nevertheless prevalent. And somewhat hypocritical, given that almost anybody in this country today has at least touched marijuana once in their life, right? And you know, my daughter started pushing back, you know, which she often did, when she thought that I was out of touch with reality. And I have to admit that I was probably at that point. And, you know, we started then that sort of catapulted into a discussion about drug use in our neighborhood and her school. And what became very evident, without getting into a lot of details, was that the kids that grew up around my kids would often use drugs at the same level that the kids in the neighborhoods that I police. But the difference was the kids in the neighborhoods that I police were generally arrested. Of course, they were poor, they were black, they were brown. And the kids in other neighborhoods did not see any policing consequences for the same behavior. And that really kind of impacted me. It really questioned my sense of fairness and justice. And that was one of the, you know, in this evolution, why I became a strong advocate for, you know, a very different approach to drug use. And quite frankly, then I became familiar with the Portuguese model much later and the whole concept of decriminalization and, you know, again. Many factors, but certainly even my own kids in their own way. I mean, I tell you, my other daughter, you know, often we would talk about, you know, people disrupting assemblies and, you know, trying to get their message across. And I would say, well, you know, why can't we have a more civilized way of handling that? And she would say, well, Dad, that's the only way that poor people get attention, right? I mean, they don't get attention any other way. And initially I would say, well, what do you mean? I say, yeah, you know, think about it for a moment. If you're poor, if you're disenfranchised, if you don't have the ability to get the attention of the media and the community, how do you do it? You have to sometimes disrupt. And so that's why, you know, later in life, I became very tolerant of public disobedience, because sometimes that's the only tool that people have in order to get their message across, right? Right. We got to get hit over the head in the larger community to see the suffering of other people, because otherwise, you know, people stay in their corner and everybody's happy and you don't see what's going on, right?
Tell me about the latter part of your tenure at the LAPD. What were you doing during that period of time? And then what led you to transition out of the department?
Yeah, so, you know, when the Rampart scandal occurred, I was already a captain, and I then Bernard Parks was the chief of police, and I thought he was very bright in when he did this, and I always complimented him for him. He decided to put together a board of inquiries to really do a deep down analysis internally as to what were the mistakes and what were the lessons learned. And I was fortunate enough that I was selected to be in the, you know, the war inquiry was massive and there were many different aspects to it, but I was fortunate enough to be selected to be in the group that was looking at supervision and management failures. And that gave me an opportunity to actually interview some of the supervisors that were not the ones that had obviously had been, you know, targeted for criminal prosecution, but the other ones that were around seeing what was happening, and the managers, and then really taking a very deep and unusual dive into what was occurring behind the scenes. And, you know, I would say that that was probably one of the biggest, you know, the biggest moments in my life to really begin to question police culture and what was allowed and what was okay. And frankly, and something that often is not discussed, the Board of Inquiries also, we had an opportunity to glean into prosecution in the bench, right? Because what often is not discussed, and I think the LA District Attorney had a, they were given a big pass here, is that they were complicit in many of the problems that were going on, because they had, there were prosecutors that were at the Rampart Station working on gang cases, and you clearly had to know that some of the way the evidence was being obtained and some of the behavior had was unlawful. But because it was one of the things where, you know, sort of the false sense of good versus evil, and you're going after evil so that, you know, the means justify the ends, people not only looked the other way, but they encouraged really bad police behavior. And then you had, quite frankly, judges that often are former prosecutors, which I think, you know, sometimes a problem, right? You know, it's okay to have some former prosecutors on the bench, but this should not be the majority of your bench. And LA County has a problem there. And then you had these judges that really, because they, you know, this is their formation too, so they were complicit also in the way that they accepted police work coming through, that everybody should have said, wait a minute, there is something wrong with this, right? So while clearly our focus was the police and police management and supervision, there were many other actors here. They had any of them jumped in and raised a red flag early on, the damage would have been mitigated. And then, of course, that led, you know, that became, quite frankly, the tool for the consent decree, because the Justice Department basically took that Bureau of Inquiry, and this was not what the LAPD planned, but I think it was a good outcome. Basically, it's like, here, you're handing us the evidence as to why there needs to be federal intervention here. And then by that time, then I had promoted. I was running training for the LAPD, so I really became very focused in creating quality constitutional training for the police department, and really on, you know, getting to learn more about adult learning systems. So again, another phase of my life which I continue to evolve and develop. And then Bill Bratton became the chief of police, and you know, then I started to run operations. Not initially I was running all the other support services. I got promoted, but I was running personnel, continued to have training, just a broader, you know, initially I was running just training, and then also again I got elevated to all the human resource and technology stuff. So each of the steps was really part of my formation, and you start learning other things, working through experts and then running operations, and then that kind of led to the point where I was recruited to be a chief of police in Mesa, Arizona.
So while you were in Mesa, obviously you came into contact with Sheriff Joe Arpaio, and I'm wondering how you were able to deal with that adversary and how you developed as a chief of police under those constraints in that situation.
Yeah, you know, so interestingly enough, Joe Arpaio and I actually start crossing our path, and really without me knowing what was in store for the future, I had already developed before I went to Mesa sort of a national reputation, you know, working in some reform circles around immigration. And the Washington Post was doing a piece, you know, that by 2005, 2006, there was this concept that MS-13 was like an existential threat to the American democracy, which was insane, right? I mean, some of those guys they do horrible things, but the American government, the American way of life was not in jeopardy because of the MS-13. And there was a congressman in the Virginia area that was trying to pass federal legislation to make certain things a federal crime. And it was very tense because there had been a horrendous homicide that had been allegedly committed by some young members of MS-13 in Virginia. And this was a time where a lot of Central American families had moved into the meatpacking companies in the Midwest and other places. So you had all these incoming folks, many coming from the Southern California, but others, you know, they were coming from war-torn El Salvador, right? A lot of political refugees. And so Arpaio then is now sort of surfacing in the late 2005, early 2006 in his anti-immigration kick, and he's becoming sort of America's toughest sheriff, and he became the sweetheart of the anti-immigration groups. And the Washington Post was doing a piece on MS-13 and, you know, what Arpaio was doing with gangs and all this stuff, and they called me sort of to get the opposite view, and I questioned the whole concept of MS-13 being an existential threat to the U.S. But what I did say is that MS-13 is an existential threat to El Salvador because it's a brand new democracy. And I have been already in El Salvador doing some technical assistance with policing. I've spent also time around Latin America and the Middle East. And so I actually said, actually, what we're doing is we're taking kids that came here at a very early age. They became a product of our American inner cities, right? Their violence was mostly driven by our violence. And now we're deporting them and we're dumping them in El Salvador. And, you know, how prophetic it was actually that, you know, now, of course, we have El Salvador has the highest homicide rate in the world. Honduras is a mess. And, you know, a lot of that really stemmed from, you know, our immigration and sort of deporting a lot of young people that, you know, really cut their teeth in violence and gangs here. So anyway, that article comes out, and obviously I'm on the other side of this, and then quite not knowing at the time, you know, probably months later, I'm being recruited to be the chief of police in Mesa, and I end up taking the job. And so I get there, we already have some bad blood going on. And then, you know, quite frankly, what I really wasn't expecting is the level of hate and xenophobic activity that were going on in Arizona, especially Maricopa County at that time. I mean, what we see now at the national level was going on in Maricopa County in 2006, right? It was on steroids. And I became kind of the person that many of the people in the Latino community would come to, if nothing else, just to vent because of frustrations. And I became very outspoken about what was going on there.
And I'm wondering if you can just be specific about what exactly was going on. What were you seeing?
I mean, I can tell you many examples. So Mesa is the third largest city in the state, second largest in Maricopa County. Phoenix is the largest. Mesa was a city of around just about 500,000 people at the time. A very conservative city, primarily governed by, you know, the original founders of the city, a lot of heavy Mormon influence. But about 30% Latino, many multiple generation Latinos. But the school district had the largest unified school district in Arizona at the time, right around 70, 80,000 kids. Almost 80% were Latinos, which just shows kind of the same thing that we see in a lot of communities where overall Latino representation may be, you know, at a point, but the younger generation is way over, right? So the school district, disproportionately Latino, and when there would be rumors that there were going to be immigration raids, which the Arpaio did regularly in Mesa, in Guadalupe, in some of the small towns in the county, the word would get out, and basically parents would stop taking their kids to school because they were afraid of getting stopped, getting deported. So the school superintendent would call me because, you know, Arizona has a similar formula for funding for K through 12 is based on daily attendance. So when a lot of kids are not showing up, that really drops the funding for the school district. So it was very frustrating to the school administration, the impact that this had. And I would have, you know, he tried to reassure the community it was okay to take the kids to school, and parents would come in, but they always had the story about somebody that got stopped and deported. So we were in the middle of this craziness. Then we had, you know, frankly, victims of crime. You know, we have one case of a young woman out of Phoenix that was the victim of a severe rape, you know, sexual attack. And she was afraid to go to the emergency room because even the emergency room were required to report if people did not have papers. So she didn't get the services that she needed. Of course, the assailant was never reported. And then he went on to, again, sexually assault another woman, this time somebody that was a U.S. citizen, to really speaks to the problem when you have local law enforcement engaged in immigration enforcement. And then that led actually to, in Mesa, the police department was the one handling the credentialing of city contractors. And one of the things that we needed to do was look at a person's immigration status according to the policy and law. And I really kind of de-emphasized that. I said, look, let's just make sure the people, you know, don't have, if they're going to have a criminal record, make sure that we understand what that is. So somebody in the police department was unhappy with the policy that I had implemented, and they complained to the sheriff's department. And one early morning, around 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, the city of Mesa was raided. Actually, the city administration offices, the main library, and later that morning, around 6 o'clock in the morning, a police facility by SWAT teams from the sheriff's department looking for unlawful or undocumented immigrants. The whole thing led to the arrest of two women in the janitorial team, including one of the two women. Actually, one of her kids was in one of our youth programs, and she was then taken in custody and deported, and, you know, very young childs were left by themselves. So, I mean, this is the kind of stuff that we were facing.
How did you respond? Well, specifically, how did you respond to that situation?
Yeah.
And how would you characterize your tenure in Mesa from that point forward?
Yeah. So, you know, we had a new mayor who, you know, I respect greatly, a very, very good man. And, you know, we obviously, he was very angry that his city was, even though he's a conservative Republican, Mormon, you know, so he said, George, we're going to do a press conference, and we did that day and really denounced what was going on. And that, you know, that led to even more tension building up. We had an incident where we had an elder within the Mormon church coming from Mexico. A lot of people don't know this, but actually the Mormon church, the main place where they have grown in the last few years has been Latin America. So a lot of the kids, when they do their missions, they do their missions in Latin America. A lot of them are bilingual. So for a lot of Mormon Republicans, it's a very conflicted place, because on the one hand, they are very socially conservative. On the other hand, they have very strong ties to Latin America. But anyway, make a long story short, it was one of the elders in the Mexican side of the church that was coming to Mesa, because his daughter, I believe, was getting married to a young man in Mesa, and they get, and he was, I mean, clearly he was lawfully here. They were driving a car with Mexican plates. They had all the right stuff. I mean, actually, it's fairly affluent men in Mexico, but they were Mexicans. And they got stopped by the sheriff's department inside of Mesa borders, again, you know, which interesting. And they go through a horrendous process. Their car gets impounded and they're left on the street. So that actually really amped up the anti-Arpaio thought process, even within the white Mormon church. So myself and a couple of other people, actually the former attorney general of the state, and the mayor of Phoenix, we went to the Justice Department, still under Bush. It was a transition from Bush to Obama, and launched the first formal complaint against Arpaio. And, you know, then much later in 2009, I was asked by a congressperson out of Tucson and a member of the Board of Supervisors in Maricopa County if I would go to the U.S. Congress and provide testimony, which I did, against what was going on. And then really kind of that was the way out. The political heat on Mesa was so high that I was asked to leave Mesa. And that's when Gavin Newsom, who was then mayor of San Francisco, recruited me first as a chief of police, and then later on I became the DA.
So I'm wondering then about that transition between being chief of police of San Francisco to becoming the district attorney of San Francisco. Was that a difficult transition for you?
So yes and no, right? So again, going back and forth, you know, I had already been involved in criminal justice reform for years. And one of the things that was very obvious to me, the further that I travel that path, which is common knowledge today, but it really wasn't common knowledge in 2010, 2011, is that mass incarceration was driven by elected DAs in this country, right? Elected DAs have so much discretion. And how they use that discretion really impacts tremendously how we incarcerate people. So when Kamala Harris became the attorney general, and you know, I've been now an attorney for about 20 years, and Gavin offered to appoint me with the condition that I had to run that year, which I did and got elected, I really came in with a very, very clear focus in finding the intersections between decarceration, criminal justice reform, and public safety. And I believe that you could do it all. And we proved that we could, right? In San Francisco, we continued to lower violent crime, and we became, you know, one of the biggest decarcerators in the state. And then I got engaged in other criminal justice reform, like Prop 36 in 2012, which was a reform of three strikes. I also got involved in Prop 34 in 2012. That one failed. That was trying to abolish the death penalty. And that transition eventually led in 2014 to work in Prop 47. I was one of the original architects. And, you know, now we have, you know, over $350 million every year that goes to counties and cities to deal with addiction and mental health. So it was a hard transition in the sense that obviously in policing, you know, you have very paramilitary organizations. Basically, by and large, you give orders and people, to some extent, you hope they'll follow it. You know, all of a sudden you're leading attorneys and everything is why, right? So it's a very different approach to managing, but also it's a very smart workforce, right? So then all of a sudden you have to deal with different challenges. And then, you know, the questions early on, well, you've never trialed a case. And, you know, I used to tell people that most airlines are run by people that have never flown a large commercial aircraft, and that usually surgeons make very poor hospital administrators, and that when you're running an organization as large as a county DA, yes, you have to understand the law, and clearly you have to understand the system, but more importantly, you have to know how to run large organizations. And I think my success and, quite frankly, my credibility within the troops and the DA's office came from that. You know, the reforms that were brought in, the professionalization that we brought in, the increase in training, better management systems, more transparency, technology. So we started doing a bunch of things that really put us at completely at a different level than what we were before. And I attribute that to my management and leadership skills.
When Larry Krasner, for example, went into Philadelphia, he established a policy where he evaluated which prosecutors were on board for the reforms he was implementing and let go of those prosecutors who weren't going to line up behind these policies. Right. How did you approach prosecutors in the DA's office in San Francisco who either were not willing to line up behind your policies or who opposed them?
Yeah, I mean, look, I took a more deliberate approach. And by the way, Larry Krasner, our friends, Larry spent time in my office before he became DA. And then after he became DA, his personnel spent a lot of time in San Francisco. San Francisco became an incubator for progressive prosecutors. But based on my, you know, many years of experience in managing large organizations and frankly working in organizations with very strong civil service protections, which Philadelphia did not have, and San Francisco was a hybrid. But, you know, I came from LAPD where, you know, you want to move somebody, you have to go through a more rigorous process. I went in with a different approach. I took an approach of very clearly the direction that we were going to go, and I gave people an opportunity to sign up for it. Now, the people that didn't sign up for it, then they, you know, they started deselecting themselves, or sometimes we encouraged them to leave and made sure that they did. But it was a more gradual process, and I think it was important because I came also in the office that two DAs prior had a former defense lawyer, not a public defender, but a former defense lawyer who came in and there was a bloodbath and a lot of people were let go. And most of them, quite frankly, were let go because they had supported the opponent. So it was really more of a political firing, which is a problem. In my case, because, you know, I came in actually having been a supporter of Kamala Harris, and so it was a more gradual approach for me, but the reality is that probably within a year and a half, a lot of people left, and I was able to bring a lot of new people. And certainly the management team, by and large, I created both from within, but also from outside. So, you know, for instance, my chief of staff was a former LA public defender. And people at first say, you're bringing a public defender into a DA's office. And I say, yes, and why? Well, because I want to have somebody that has done the other side of the equation, because I benefit from the robust conversation in my inner circle, right? I often tell people that the last thing that you want to be is you don't want to be the emperor walking naked, right? You want people that are going to push back, that are going to question. I believe that, you know, good public policy, well, good management and leadership comes from having constantly people question one another. So I was always looking not only for diversity of, you know, gender and race, but also diversity of thinking. And I think that I benefited greatly from that process. But the reality, you know, I mean, within a period of time, you know, people that are not going to sign up, they're going to leave. Now, I'm not going to tell you that everybody was always 100%, and clearly there were some hardcore prosecutors there that probably wished that I was not around. But we were able to achieve a great deal of reform, and we did it in a way that it worked better for San Francisco. Now, I think Larry also came into a very difficult place because he came in a place where his predecessor had been incarcerated for corruption, and there were people in that administration that also were engaged in corruption. So I did not have that, right? So Larry came in, obviously, with a very different set of circumstances, not only as to what was going on inside the office, but also what he needed to achieve. And, you know, I tell people that a lot of this stuff, there's not always a right or wrong. I mean, there are some things that are clearly wrong, some things that are clearly right, but there's a lot of gray. And you have to be really thoughtful about how you do a transition in an organization. Frankly, if I were to get elected DA in LA, again, it's going to be is a different set of scenarios, right? You have now full civil service across the board, right? So your lawyers and everybody has full civil service. So obviously the approach to shifting the culture within the organization will be different, but that doesn't mean that we're not going to shift the culture. We will. And some people will be unhappy and they'll either become an internal terrorist or they'll leave. And I know certainly how to deal with both.
I want to go back to your tenure as San Francisco DA in a second, but do you think that if you're elected DA here in Los Angeles, you would replicate the action of naming a former public defender as your chief of staff?
Look, I mean, I think everything is on the table, right? I mean, the one thing that I'm going to do, which I've always done, I look for talent wherever talent is. And, you know, we have a lot of work to do. This is an office that is really backwards. I mean, it's an office that, frankly, I always tell people that the criminal justice system in L.A. County is stuck in the past. But actually, yesterday, there was one of the most interesting moments. We were at a public event, and the current DA said that she was the same person today. She was in 1986. And I said to myself, wow, no wonder that we're so backwards, right? I mean, if you think about it, 1986, you know, we were using desktops. DeLorean has just come out, right? And now we have phones that have the computing capacity that it took a large frame computer in a room probably the size of this living room to hold the capacity that we have today. So the fact that we have a district attorney that proudly says she's the same person that was in 1986 really just so crystallizes what we are, right? Because technology, science, knowledge has increased so much. And I think that one of the capacities of a human being is, I think, for good human development is to develop and grow and learn. And I tell people that every day I try to learn something new. And if I'm definitely not the same person that I was in 1986. And I'm proud of that, by the way.
So how have you changed since 1986?
I'm sorry?
How have you changed since 1986?
Oh, my goodness. Obviously, I think I'm intellectually superior to where I was in 1986 because I intentionally have looked for knowledge. I continue to learn every day. I think that, the way that I look at the work of the criminal justice system is completely different to how I did
so?
There. Well, you know, look, I don't believe that, that the war on drugs was successful. I don't believe that, in fact, I believe that it was extremely damaging, right? I don't believe that, incarcerating people the way that we did has gotten anywhere, you know, and there's a lot of science and a lot of data to support that, right? But you know, for me, there has been an evolution of learning and continuing to seek knowledge and talking to other people. I believe that I'm a much better human being. Not that I consider myself a bad human being in 1986, but, you know, I was a product of that environment then. And hopefully I'm a product of a more enlightening reality today. And frankly, I think if you and I get together for a podcast 4 years from now, I look forward to being also different, right? Continue to grow.
I'd like to just touch on a few aspects of your tenure as DA in San Francisco. As you mentioned, you were one of the advocates behind Prop 47. There's a lot of...
More than an advocate. I was one of the architects. Probably so, by the way.
And we covered a congressional field hearing where Michael Romano spoke and several other advocates spoke about the impact of Prop 47 and the reality of the statistics. But you are facing a lot of mythology that's grown around it, a lot of disinformation that's grown around it. What I'm wondering is how you respond to the campaign that's out there to blame the rise in property crime on Prop 47, and specifically the mythology that gangs and criminal operations are using people who qualify for Prop 47 relief in order to do their dirty work.
Yeah. I mean, look, it gets so ridiculous now that I've heard merchants say that the thieves come in with a calculator and they start adding the dollar amount to how much they're going to take to make sure that they don't go over the threshold. It's very crazy. But look, let's get to the real stuff, right? I'm going to use Department of Justice numbers because, you know, we may agree or disagree, but they're... You know, they're not there supporting me or not supporting me or lazy or not, right? During my tenure as a San Francisco DA, we reduce incarceration to a fourth of what LA County does, and violent crime went down, while violent crime in LA County has gone up by 30% during the tenure of the current DA and by a little over 50% in the city of LA. So first of all, we know that Prop 47 and the impact of Prop 47 has nothing to do with violent crime. But then the question comes up, so yeah, but your property crime skyrocketed, right? And then we said, well, do you understand that in San Francisco during my tenure, 60% of the property crime that accounted for that increase was car break-ins? And the car break-ins are not impacted by Prop 47. They're still a felony. And that in 81,000 car break-ins in a period of about a little over 4 years, there were 13 arrests made by the San Francisco Police Department. 13 arrests, 81,000 cases. And remember that prosecutors cannot prosecute an empty chair. Somebody has to be brought in. But then more importantly, we get new leadership about 2 years ago in the San Francisco Police Department. And that new leadership comes to work with the DA. And in the last 2 years, we lowered car break-ins by 20%. So under Prop 47, different leadership, we reduce property crimes. We continue to reduce violent crime. So the facts are that police still has tools, that the tools that we have actually are more enlightening. The other thing that people don't talk about is that, you know, we are basically taking back about $350 million every year, and we're pouring it back into local communities. L.A. County has gotten almost $70 million from Prop 47. L.A. City has gotten over $25 million. Now, the fact that they have chosen sometimes to use it for the city attorney to prosecute quality of life issues, that's not what the intent was. The intent is for services. But the reality is that we have thousands of people that are benefiting not only from the criminal justice relief, but also from the services they're getting, that are getting housing, they're getting them employment. And how can you argue that using a concrete box is going to somehow fix mental health and drug addiction? No, that would be like saying, I'm going to take a hammer and I'm going to cure cancer by beating you with a hammer, right? So the reality is that when you peel the onion here and you really get to the essence of what we're talking about, is we're talking about what the current DA just said yesterday. I'm still in 1986, right? And unfortunately, a lot of law enforcement is still in 1986. And Prop 47 is really a 21st century solution that is based on science and data for a 21st century problem. Look, when I was a young cop, we had drug addicts, we had homelessness. We used to incarcerate them. I remember putting people in jail and then prison because they had a small quantity of drugs and they were under the influence. I remember some of those faces, you know, sometimes a vacant look or sometimes a view of anger. I look back now and say, how much harm were we doing, right? And to say that continuing that process is going to fix us, or to say, well, now you lost the stick, and the stick is a felony conviction. And you say, well, have you thought about that a felony conviction is almost a guarantee that somebody's not going to get employment, and they're going to lose their housing, and they're going to be homeless? And they say, yeah, but you don't understand. We could use that stick to send people to drug court. And I say, wonderful. So before Prop 47, how many people do you think were going to drug court in the county of LA a year before? Take a guess. County of 10.5 million people. Under 3,400 people. So on a county of 10.5 million people, before Prop 47, we had about 3,400 people that actually about 60% of those might have been helped by this. And you're going to tell me that, but we hang a felony conviction on thousands and thousands of people that are homeless today. And you're going to tell me that going back to that is a good thing?
Wow. Can you talk about the prosecution of Christopher Boucher?
Bukhari
for vehicular homicide, yeah, while he was riding his bicycle?
Yeah. This is probably one of the most egregious cases of gross carelessness for people around you. And, you know, a lot of white privilege here, too. And a lot of the, you know, also add a little bit of the bro culture within the tech industry, all of it problematic, but because there's a lot of sense of entitlement here. So this is a guy that is coming from Marin County, you know, very affluent county near San Francisco, riding his bike. And he is, he basically blows through multiple red lights in his bike because he's competing with himself. You know, he's tracking his prior time. And he's going through a very crowded area in the Castro, and basically he's going to blow another red light. He's already blown a few. And when he realizes coming down this hill at a very high rate of speed, he has a red light, and there are people on the crosswalk. And he, in his own version of events, he was too committed to stop. So he continues forward, and he lays the bike, and he strikes an elderly gentleman who was there with his family, a grandfather, and he kills this person. And then, to add insult to injury, he starts posting an eulogy to his helmet because the helmet has bravely sacrificed itself to save Mr. Bucheri's life or Bucheri's life. So the level of callousness in this case is just like I've never seen anything like it. So here you are, you just kill someone. You took a grandfather away from their family through your gross criminal negligence. But on top of that, you have the audacity to do an eulogy to your helmet because the helmet saved your life. Not an ounce of remorse, not an ounce of apology, not an ounce of, oh my God, I just took the life of another human being because of my incredible selfishness. And, we looked at this case and we said, if there is ever a case that needs to be prosecuted as a felony, it's this case, right? This was a poster child of vehicular manslaughter. And he was tried and he was convicted. At the same time, I have to tell you that, he was going to be tried. I also recognized what prison works and when prison doesn't work. And he did not have a criminal record. And even though he's incredibly insensitive and probably extremely self-centered, prisons are not designed for the self-centered and the insensitive, right? And so I knew that, prison sentencing wasn't necessarily going to make Bucheri a better human being. And it was not going to bring back, unfortunately, the person that died. But certainly, getting his attention by prosecuting him was important. Because one of the jobs of a prosecutor is to make sure that we provide the right level of intervention based on the circumstances. So he pled to a felony. He was convicted. And interestingly enough, he's now decided to start independent expenditures against me because he still doesn't get it that his behavior was horrendous. He still hasn't apologized, by the way, to the family. I have to tell you, this is also when you see the greatness and the not so great in humanity, right? The family of the victim in this case, I have never seen more gracious people. How humble, how stoic they were in the way they handled this. I don't know that I would have had the same. I knock on wood, God hopefully never tests me that way, because I don't know that I would have been that stoic about it. But to have this person now come out and, start buying Facebook ads against me because I prosecuted him, it's like the ultimate insult to this family. And I don't think I can say any more.
I'm conscious of your time. You've been very, very generous with it. I want to ask one more question. I want to offer Molly a chance to ask one more. I'd like to talk about CalGang and the gang database, your experience with it as San Francisco police chief and district attorney, and the current scandal that's blown up in the Los Angeles Police Department.
Yeah, certainly in my years in policing, we use Cal gangs. We often use it as a tool, and certainly I did in San Francisco. And then as a district attorney in the early stages, we did some gang enhancements, never to the level of LA, but we did some. And again, this is an area where the more did you look into it, the more you peel the onion, the more that I've come to the conclusion that A, gang enhancements are so problematic that I would not use them. And this is where, I want to kind of divert a little why I think science and research is important. So One of the things that I did is I engaged Stanford Law School to come in and take a look at the impact of status enhancements in our practice, because I began to be uncomfortable with the whole concept in 2016. And it took about a year, year and a half to get all the data and come back. We tried to do a statewide process, but could not get any other prosecutors to open the books. So the data only San Francisco, which is probably less impactful because we use so much less, right? We had the lowest per capita rate of prison commitments. And so, but even in our own data, we began to see after the study that, you know, there were certain status enhancements that really, even as differing as we were, that still increased prison commitments in a way that didn't necessarily make us safer. So now you fast forward to where I am today, where I basically think, you know, gang enhancements need to go. And then the scandal comes up with the LAPD, which is really kind of is heartbreaking for me because, frankly, I thought that LAPD had, you know, we went through the consent decree. We went through all this stuff. You think that we would be in a different place. And it's like we're reliving the past. And, you know, now I look at it and say, well, you know, the nagging question for me is this only this 19 or 20 officers? I don't think so, right? So what else is there? So I personally have come to the conclusion that first, we have to get rid of Cal gangs. Certainly, I will not be using gang enhancements if I were to be elected DA. I think if somebody commits murder, they get charged with murder, right? You don't have to add, you know, another, a little more salt into the condiment if they get convicted. That's what they did, or robbery. But now the whole concept of even looking at Cal gangs, I find it so problematic that I've come to the conclusion that we have to pivot away. And I, you know, frankly, I hope that the LAPD moves away from it. I hope that, frankly, we find a way to get rid of the Cal gangs altogether. Because if this problem is going on in LAPD with all the structures that are in place, supposedly, I can only imagine what's going on throughout the state, where you have, quite frankly, agencies that nobody's looking over their shoulder. They don't have an inspector general. They don't have a police commission. So I really question now how many more brown and black kids are in that database that should never have been. And more importantly, how many brown and black kids are now in prison as a result of being in a database that has so many problems.
So I want to end by talking about diversion. In the last debate, you quoted the RAND study that recently came out, and that study found that 61% of LA County's jail population with mental health issues could be eligible for diversion. And Jackie Lacey has said, she said in that debate, you have to have a place to divert people. You can't just put them back on the street. So if you were elected to office, would you divert these individuals? And how would you ensure that they wouldn't end up back on the street?
Yeah, well, the first thing that they should never go into jail in the first place, right? We would not take a cancer patient and put them in jail to cure them. But we take a mentally ill and put them in jail because we don't have any place else to put them. I mean, the conclusion of that is really morally reprehensible. So actually, her statement, when you really start breaking it down, is morally reprehensible. So I know that this is not the place to go fix it, but I'm going to put them there because I don't have anywhere else. Okay, so it's like a cancer patient walking down the street, like, I'm sorry, we don't have chemo for you, but we're going to put you in jail in the meantime until we find the chemo for you, right? So that is so problematic. But the other part is that if you start getting people out of the jail system and start creating bandwidth to have services and start using money from Prop 47, for instance, instead of using it like it's being used in LA for prosecuting quality of life issues, you use it for what it was intended, which is services. If you start taking a good inventory, not only of the current service available, but also where is the capacity in other places to bring services, I think the conversation would be very different, right? And I would say that we would never think of taking a cancer patient and putting them in county jail because we don't have a chemo bed somewhere, right? But we consistently put mentally ill into the setting, and we have to stop that practice.
George Gascon, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you so much to both of you. Thank you for the opportunity.
That concludes the interview that Molly Miller and I conducted with George Gascon. For more storytelling news and narrative analysis, head over to crimestory.com. Thank you for joining us, and we hope you will come back for the next Crime Story podcast.